My name is Mark. I'm host of Black Knight Meditations, the Tuesday night metal show featuring Black Death, thrash, doom, shred, power prog, folk, traditional metal. And those of you who tune in to B&M every Tuesday night know of my affinity for Wasp and how much I just worship at the altar of Blackie Lawless. The man is an amazing songwriter. I've been a fan since 1988, and every album that Wasp has issued, I've been in love with. Wasp is one of those rare bands that I actually thoroughly enjoy and love every single release. And Blackie, do you hear that much from your fans that say that, man, you know, Wasp, you guys have never put out a bad record. Everything you touch turns to gold. Do you hear that much?
Well, first of all, I should say you're far, far too kind.
I'm honest, though, man. I'm dead serious. I'm not kidding.
You know, we've been really, really lucky, really blessed. You know, the fan base has stayed with us for a long time. And, you know, if you got 10 people, you're going to have 10 different opinions. But for the most part, we've been lucky, and the consistency of the fans have been right there for a long time.
Well, hopefully you'll get some new fans with the new album called Babylon. And those who have not heard the new record yet, if you've heard the last few records, you're gonna know what you're getting into, because Babylon is not a departure. It's the Wasp we know and we love. And from fan feedback, Blackie, do you get much fan feedback from people stating, I love what you do, can you try something different, can you go off in the left field and do something completely different, or do you just stick, you just hear most fans saying, we love what you do, don't ever change? Do you get much of that, people saying, do something
it's
different?
It's usually more of the latter. But, you know, from a songwriter's point of view, really what you're trying to do, and I know this may sound incredibly selfish to you, but I can't base what I do on what anybody
says. You have to please yourself.
I have to do what's right for me, because it's kind of like tailoring a suit of clothes to somebody else. You can't do that. You have to do it for yourself.
Right. And you know,
and because when I'm making records, I'm not trying to think about what's hot in the marketplace.
Thank you.
Or what's popular right now or any of that stuff. I'm thinking about who I am right at that moment. What am I thinking? What am I feeling? Because the person I am right now, that ain't who I was 5 years ago. You know, so if I'm going to make an honest record, I have to reflect who I am at the moment. So I can't worry about any outside influences. I guess what I'm trying to say in a nutshell here is that you have to do what you do, stick to your guns, and follow it through. Because if you don't, you end up being a phantom idea of what somebody thinks you are, and you're not true to yourself. And if you're not true to yourself, you're certainly not going to be true to the fans.
And I was going to say that the fans would know if you're putting out something that is not true to yourself. I mean, we'd know. We would know that if you were trying to follow a trend or trying to be something that you're not. I mean, the fans are savvy. We've been with you long enough throughout your career to know. You know, I will say that while there are certain things that I would like to hear on a Wasp record, I don't want you to do anything you don't want to do. And I think most of your fans would agree. You've taken a few detours here and there, just a little bit, like on a KFD record with the production of that album. But again, love it. It worked. It sounded great. And again, Wasp is a band that you just haven't put out a bad record. Now, having said that, every album that comes out that you put out, I have to think, okay, is this the one where I'm finally let down? Is this the one I'm finally going to say, I just don't want to ever hear this again? But thankfully, that has not happened. Now, let's talk live, because live shows, because you're going to be in Foxborough, Mass., right in our neck of the woods on Tuesday, March 9th, and this is at the Showcase Live venue, which is connected to the stadium that the New England Patriots play. And I know you're a big Oakland Raiders fan. Being a big football guy, you think you might stir the pot a little bit when you come out on stage and wear a Raiders jersey just to rub it in the noses?
Well, I appreciate the sentiment. To be totally honest with you, and you're going to love this. I mean, I grew up in New York, so my first love was the Giants. As far as being a Raiders fan, it's not, you know, that's, let's just say that's not dyed in the wool. You know, it's just, and also that being said, I'm a bigger baseball fan than I am a football guy anyway.
Well, then we can get into Red Sox versus whatever team you think is good, which...
whatever team I think is good?
Well, come on, if it's not the Red Sox, then what's the point, right?
Oh, you guys are so provincial up there.
Okay, well, who is your baseball team?
Are you serious?
I'm dead serious, and the reason why I ask this is because I'm trying to tell you something here. Like, who is your baseball team? Red Sox, right? Come on.
It's those pinstripe boys to the west of you.
See, I opened the door for you. You could have walked right in and, oh, come on. All right, well, you know what? I think after this coming season, you're going to be proven that, you know, you should have come over to our side. But, hey, you know.
You may be right. That's
a discussion for another time. But, hey, you had your run last year, so I give you that. So,
and 26 times prior.
Oh, okay. Thanks for pointing that out. So again, with live performances, you've been talking in various interviews you've been doing lately about the live sets that you're doing, and that the songs that you've chosen for the set list are geared towards the video presentation that you have. But what I want to know is, did you have some songs for the video presentation that did not work out that you wanted to add to the set?
Were yes.
There was
probably a half a dozen things. Because what happens is that when you get ready to do a show, it's kind of like best laid plans of mice and men. You have all these wonderful ideas on paper you think is going to work. But when you actually get into the rehearsals, a lot of factors come into play. Part of it is the pacing of the set. And this is all kind of technical stuff that people don't really probably care about. But when you get in there, you'll find out sometimes that things individually work on their own. But sometimes they don't work in the context of a show, or sometimes they don't work in the placement of a show.
That makes sense.
And the pace has a lot to do with it. You know, and this show right now is about an hour and 40 minutes. And so to maintain a flow where there's an energy level throughout the thing, all that stuff you have to take in consideration. So when we went in, like I said, there was a lot of stuff that we took in that just did not make the cut. And it's not because they weren't good. Because if we did a promo video for them at any given point, it was probably a pretty good song. But, like I said, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to work in the context of putting a live show together.
Now, would that factor into saying having too many of the slower ballady type songs?
Because nope, that not wouldn't at all.
Okay. So you feel that you could do in an hour and 40 minutes, you know, several ballads within a set. You think you don't think that would be a problem? Because you were talking about flow, and I'm just...
Yeah, because you have to have contrast. I mean, you can't... Not everything can be on 10. You know, you have to build into the show areas where, you know, you have some sort of a relief. You know, but then again, I mean, there's songs that there were never promo videos done that we still have footage to. Because when we did The Headless Children 20 years ago, we had footage for a lot of songs on that show. And, you know, unless you saw that tour when we did it in 89, you wouldn't know this. But, like, for the song Headless Children, I mean, there's video footage that goes along behind us while we're playing.
It's a great
song.
You
know, so it's stuff like that. You know, and there'll be things also that people have never seen before. So, but we ask ourselves, well, is Headless a slow song? It's a slow song, you know, but is it a ballad? No. But it has the same effect as a ballad does, because it takes the pacing of the show down.
Oh, that's a killer song.
You know, again, we're back to the idea of how do all these components fit together when you string it into an hour and 40 minutes.
Now, you were mentioning about earlier about you have to please yourself when it comes to writing and recording records. But what about when it comes to live set lists? I mean, you're always going to hear from the fans, you know, play this, play that. You don't play enough of the old stuff, or
right.
you play too much of the old stuff, or what about the forgotten songs? So how much of a role does fan feedback play into what you present live?
Well, the first thing you have to do is you have to ask yourself, if I was going to see this guy, what would I want to see? And by doing that, really what you're doing is you're saying, all right, we're going to take an average of what we think people want to hear. Now, you're always going to get people that are going to come up to you from time to time and give you, I mean, they would be tickled pink if you did obscure B-sides all night.
Yeah, I'm one of them. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay, but the problem with that theory is that you're going to have about 90% of that audience
who don't
ready
know it.
To riot.
Yeah, I know.
You know.
I totally understand.
You can't do that. You know, so it's kind of like when a band comes out with a new record, they have a tendency to want to play a lot of material off that new record because it's new and they like it and what have you. But the problem with that is that there may be half that audience out there that doesn't have that record or maybe has never even heard the record before. So if you're playing too much new music off that new record, that really does become self-indulgent. So you got to really kind of take an average of what you think people want to hear.
Well,
and that's how you base it.
And when you're writing songs for an album, do you ever take into account during the writing process how they might come across in a live setting?
No. No, you can't. I mean, well, I take that back. There are times during the process that you may have the thought pop into your head like, oh, wow, I wonder what this is going to sound like, or maybe this is going to sound really good. But that's not the primary thing I'm concentrating on. That's almost an afterthought. It's not the primary thing, because the universe of playing live and the universe of recording are two completely different places.
Right.
You know, they have nothing to do with each other. They are two completely different sciences. So you really have to make the records for the record, and if you then have something that comes off of it that then translates live, then, you know, whoopee. You know, that's just, you know, more beer for us. But the problem with that is, like I said, you can't always base what you're doing on that, because I'll tell you right now, and we're not the only band that's ever run up against this problem. You'll have things that you record in the studio, and you think, this is going to sound terrific live. You take it into rehearsal to play it, and it dies an ugly death right there in the middle of the room. You know, because for a million reasons, or the possibilities that there are so many different components going on in the recording, in the mixing process, and people don't understand, you know, how things can be translated and sometimes lost forever in a mix that you never get back again. It can die right there. And at the same time, you get the opposite effect. You'll have things that think, well, you know what? I don't think we're ever going to be able to pull this off. And you go into rehearsal and kaboom, it comes down like a ton of bricks on you, you know, and it's really good. So it's, you know, it's best laid plans of mice and men, because see, when you do your first album, you have all these years of, you know, rehearsing it in your garage and playing it live in front of people where you can test market it and all that stuff. And you know before you ever make that record what songs are going to work. After that, you never have that opportunity again to kind of so-called test drive that material in front of an audience. You just never have that opportunity ever again. So, and at the same time, like I said, to experiment with things in a rehearsal room is different than what that product is going to be when it's recorded.
When on tour, whether this tour and previous tours, what recording is going on backstage on the tour bus? Do you have somebody walking around with little handheld camera recording footage that might see the light someday? Because I think fans would want to see what's going on backstage at a Wasp show.
We do have footage that exists of that stuff. The question is, when will it surface? And I've been asked that, you know, a ton of times.
Right.
And I really can't tell you, because the problem is like, where is the time to slot something like that in?
Mm.
Because right now we're getting ready. Well, this record really came out in fall of last year. We started the tour in the beginning of October. This tour is going to go until Christmas of this year. And so by the time you're finished with that record, you know, from the time our first show happened, the first show was in Moscow in October. So by the time we can do an entire world tour and then get back to get in the studio again, it's going to be at least 2 years before we can get back to wherever the beginning of the tour started. And people think, well, you know, when they don't see you for a couple of years, they think, well, what's the band doing? Oh, they're down there in Jamaica, you know, laying on the beach. No, wrong. They don't realize there's real people in Sydney, Australia. There's real people in Buenos Aires, Argentina. There's real people in Kansas City, Missouri. You know, and to get to all these places takes, you know, it takes a really long time. You know, so like I said, to do all of these things and to promote it properly, then where do you find time to put some of this other stuff out that you're talking about? You know, as of right now, I don't really foresee a time to be able to slot that in, because the problem that exists now, we've got more things that we can actually do than we have time to do it in.
Yeah, I know the feeling.
So, and I guess that's probably a good problem to have,
yeah.
But it's a little frustrating at the same time.
Well, hey, I'm sure you've got some people out there in Wasp Nation who would love to help you out with getting this stuff together. I mean, even if informally, like if on a Wasp YouTube channel, just putting stuff out informally, you know. But you know, I understand. Like you were saying, it's a good problem to have. There's more stuff to do than there is time to do it. And
just, yep.
I, in my line of work, I know what that's about. So I can feel for you, man. I cannot even imagine what you must be going through having to book the tour,
says,
promote
what's it
the
like?
Tour.
You know, and I said, well, you ever seen a dog standing in the middle of the room and chasing his butt, you know, well, that's us, you know.
And that's a new stage maneuver for you, just chase your tail on stage.
It wouldn't be the first time, believe me.
How, other than doing interviews like with what you're doing now, how active and how hands-on are you with the Wasp, the business end of Wasp? In other words, outside of promotion, how hands-on are you, like, say, when dealing with record labels and picking everything from down to, you know, how your releases are put together to, you know, I just want to know how hands-on you are. Do you like to step back and just take the artist role?
Well, I would love to step back and just take the artist role, but it doesn't really work like that. You know, I've said to people many times, you know, all I ever wanted to do was get up on stage and sing and play a little bit, and it turned into all of this, you know. But the short answer to your question is very involved.
Cool. So that way, if something goes wrong, we can say, hey, it's all Blackie's fault.
somebody will have to take the rap.
Yeah. How when it comes to being on tour, how accessible are you to the fans? I mean, are you accessible in that after the show you'll meet with people who've hung around waiting to see you, or do you like to stick to only to pre-scheduled meet and greets? How accessible are you?
Well, here's the problem. Like with what I'm doing with you right now, there's a lot of that. And something people don't realize is that when you're going to do a tour and a record, over the course of that tour, you're going to do anywhere from 500 to 800 interviews. That's a lot of talking. And so when you throw out a number like that, you say, well, it doesn't sound like that much.
Yeah,
but if you take in consideration each one of them is 30 minutes or more, you know, then where do you find time to do them all?
Right.
You know, so the demands that are put on you when you're on the road are tremendous, because what'll happen is, like, when your day starts, when you go in for sound check, you know, whether it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon or whatever it's going to be, that's when your day really starts, and it's going to go until, say, maybe 2 in the morning. And so when you're done, a lot of times you can't put sentences together anymore. You know, you're just spitting on yourself and babbling, you know, because you really start to get punchy after a while. So what we'll do after the show is, if somebody wants to talk to us or, you know, meet us or something like that, you know, we'll sign autographs and stuff. But the ability to sit down and really talk to people in the way that I would really like to sometimes, because I would like, you know, one thing I've learned from talking to people is they think they're getting a lot out of it when they're talking to you. But I find I get more out of talking to them, because I can do little market surveys at the same time.
Like, give us some examples of what you mean by that.
Well, like I said, all right, when I'm talking to anybody out there, you know, the best way to catch any artist, whether it's me or somebody else, it's not at a show. It's if you see them in a restaurant, or, you know, you're talking about going to a ball game or something like that. That's the best place to catch them. And if you really want to have a conversation with them, don't talk to them about what they do. Talk to them about something you think they might like. I mean, if the guy's into race cars, or, you know, you're talking about playing ball or something, maybe he's a baseball fan or football fan, you know, talk about something other than their work, because put yourself in their place for a second. If you were a mechanic and you worked on cars all day and all you did was fix brakes, would you want to go home and fix brakes later that night? Probably not. You know, you would want to do something that's unrelated to what your work is. You know, so it's the same thing with what we do. But going back to your question is, you know, how do I do that? Well, when I'm talking to people, you know, they want to ask me questions, but inadvertently I end up picking their brain, you know, because I want to hear what they have to say, because I already know what my stuff is, you know.
All
and
right.
It's like, you know, I'm not really that interested in what I have to say. I'm more interested in what they have to say, you know, because that way I'm going to learn something out of it. And like I said, it's far more entertaining for me to pick their brain.
Well, on that note, how often are you on the Wasp Nation forum reading what the fans have to say?
Never. Because the problem with that is that you don't have dialogue, you know, and you also have to remember that when you're doing that, you're only getting a sampling of what maybe just a few people are saying, and that can skew you really badly. You know, it can make you end up going and thinking, it'll prejudice you. It'll start pointing you in directions that'll become confusing to you and make you do things that you don't want to do. If you're going to stay true to yourself, and any real artist will tell you this, you got to kind of be a hermit. You know, you got to kind of live in your own world. And somebody says to me, well, when you're making a record, what do you listen to? I'm not listening to anything. I'm listening to what I'm doing. You know, I'm not listening to other bands, you know, because it's too easy to get influenced when you're doing that. And this might not be that easy for people to understand, but if you're going to be true to yourself, you got to kind of lock yourself in a room somewhere, and, you know, you come out when it's finished.
Let's go back to the new album, Babylon. Thankfully, there's no filler on the record. I like every track, thankfully. One track that stands out for me, that's my favorite right now, is a track called Thunder Red. Give me some background on this particular song.
Well, Thunder Red is an extension of the title track, Babylon's Burning, because the cover of the album, you got the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, and the original plan for the record was that we were going to do one song for each of the Four Horsemen, because all the Four Horsemen are different colors. You have a pale rider, a red rider, a black rider, and a white rider. And so we were going to do one song for each color on the record. But after I got done with Babylon's Burning and Thunder Red, I thought, well, you know, I've really made my point with just these two songs of what I'm trying to say on the subject matter. I didn't think there was really anything more I could say in relationship to that. So, you know, I mean, pardon the pun, you don't want to beat a dead horse at that point.
Right.
You know, but, you know, I just thought, you know, I'd made that point with that, and I'd said everything I could with those two.
Well, is that a song that we might be seeing live on this tour?
Not right now,
okay.
Because the only two that we're doing right now is Babylon's Burning and Crazy.
Crazy, right.
Because that, too, goes back to the idea that you got to be careful about playing too much new stuff, because there might be people out there that have never heard it before.
Yeah, I totally understand. I want to ask you about a couple of other songs you've done throughout your career that really stick out for me personally. I've always loved the song Keep Holding On. And that's a song that's one of the songs where if I hear live in concert, if you were to do that, hint, hint, down in Foxborough in March, I could just close my eyes and just drift away during that song. Can you give me a brief history of that song, how that song came to be?
Is the result of a very painful relationship had ended just prior to that.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
And I think it's a good song. But it's one of those songs I will never listen to because I understand the origins of it.
Right. And what about a song that I really dig called My Wicked Heart? Because reading the lyrics, I'm having to ask myself, you know, how autobiographical are those lyrics for you?
Well, most everything I do is, because, you know, if we go back to the concept of trying to make records who you are at that moment, you know, that's really the truest way to make records. You know, so I'm reflecting, you know, what I'm thinking at that time, you know, and a song like that is interesting because, you know, what I think and what I feel right now from what my wicked heart at the time, I'm really asking a question. It sounds like I'm making a defiant statement, you know, when it says nothing can change my wicked heart. But if you look at the rest of the lyrics, it's a guy that's attempting, it's really somebody who's just, you know, BSing himself, you know, appearing to make a defiant statement, but at the time is really asking a question of who he is in his life. You know, and that's the one thing that I discovered a couple of years ago about most of the stuff that we've done, that if you look, there's a common thread that has run through from the first album till now. And that common thread is, who am I and where am I going? You know, and somebody says, well, how's the first album tying that? I want to be somebody.
Right.
You know, I was asking that question even then. And I didn't realize I was doing it. And I went back, and like I said, I didn't realize this until a couple of years ago. And I went back, and I started looking at some of the other records, and I thought, wow, I've been asking this question from day one. What I'm doing, you know, it's one of those self-examination things where you're, you know, it's you're just trying. We're all on a road, on a journey, and it's that journey of self-discovery.
Does the song Fistful of Diamonds, is that representative of how you were at that moment when you wrote that song?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's all about my name is Jimmy, I take all you gimme. You know, it's all about me, me, me.
All right, one more question.
And I was that's definitely, you know, where I was at that moment.
I know you got to go. I want to touch on one more thing. A fan has asked me to ask you about your pre-Wasp stuff. You know, we're talking old stuff here, and I've heard some of this material, and he's wondering how you regard the old pre-Wasp stuff. You know, we're talking Circus Sister, that stuff. How do you regard the old music? I mean, have you even heard those songs recently?
No, but there was, you know, the band Sister that we had was really Wasp, you know, in a different incarnation. And, I mean, we looked the same, we sounded the same. The difference was is that, you know, me developing as a songwriter,
right.
You know, that was really the key. Plus, you know, the climate wasn't right, you know, as far as record labels looking to sign bands at that point. You know, I mean, there was an explosion that came out of L.A. in 82, 83, because the record labels at that point were then ready to sign rock again.
Mm.
You know, that's the reason you had all these bands that, you know, appeared to have come out of nowhere. Well, they didn't come out of nowhere. All those bands had been out here for years,
right.
You know, slaving away in their garages writing these songs. And when the moment was right, that's how that explosion happened, you know, because they've been slaving away for years cooking up those songs, you know.
Well, we're due for another one.
You know, it was similar with us as well. You know, we were in a situation where we were developing our craft as songwriters, you know. So that would say that's really the biggest difference.
Well, Blackie, thank you very much for your time. I know you got the commitments you have to get to. The new album is called Babylon, and again, I can't say enough about it. I love it just as I love every other Wasp record. And thank you for your time. I look forward to seeing you at the Showcase Live down in Foxborough, Mass. On Tuesday, March 9th. I will definitely be there, and we're looking forward to that hour and 40-minute set. And hey, if you want to wear a Raiders jersey, hey, if you want to stir the pot even more and wear a Yankees jersey, feel free, go ahead.
I'm brave,
the fans
but I
will
ain't
love
that
it.
Brave. Thanks for having me.
Take care, Blackie, and we'll see you
soon.
Take care
now.
Take care.
Bye-bye.